You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House Live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up on the programme, almost every day for the last 18 months that Bashar al-Assad has clung onto power has been a defiance of expectations. But assuming he can't hang on forever, what happens the day after he goes? Burma, long one of the world's most repressive and secretive regimes, abolishes the official scrutinising of Burmese media prior to publication. We'll ask what has brought on this sudden enthusiasm for press freedom.
None of the laws that have been used to jail journalists have been repealed. There's no laws introduced that guarantee journalists have the freedom to report that there's real freedom of expression in Burma. What has happened is the president has decided that one of the laws the government has on the books will not be applied. But literally at the stroke of the president's pen, all of these laws can be reintroduced.
Following Julian Assange's Eva Peron impression on the balcony of Ecuador's London embassy yesterday, we'll remember a famous and somewhat ominous example of embassy squatting. And Tom Edwards, our news editor, will be here for a chat to discuss what Norway might do with all its spare sacks of cash. So all that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. But before all that and more besides, the headlines with Roger Crisp.
Monocle 24 News. More than 250 miners are appearing at a magistrate's court in Pretoria, South Africa today, facing charges including murder, attempted murder and assault, after 44 people were killed in a week of violence at Lonmin Mine northwest of Johannesburg. The riot was sparked by bitter rivalry between two competing trade unions. The Lonmin Platinum Mine produces 12% of the total global production. Former world chess champion Garry Kasparov says he plans to open a criminal case for assault against a Moscow police officer. The 49-year-old chess player, who is a critic of President Putin, was taking part in a protest outside a Moscow courthouse, where a judge was sentencing anti-Putin punk band Pussy Riot.
I was physically assaulted, illegally detained police officers, and the man who has been accusing me of biting his hand, as a matter of fact, was hitting me with this hand, and even at the end of this incident, he was shown by simply having his hand with maybe a little bruise, which could be identified as anything but a bite.
Meanwhile, a Moscow court has turned down a petition from a gay activist who wished to be allowed to hold gay pride rallies in Moscow in 2012 and for the next 100 years. The United Nations World Food Programme has started the first in a series of airdrops that aim to replenish rapidly diminishing food stocks for more than 1,000 people who have fled to South Sudan to escape the fighting north of the border. Russian Ilyushin 76 planes are taking off from nearby Ethiopia to carry out the airdrops. The 32 metric tons of wheat the Russian plane can carry is enough to feed more than 2,100 people for a month. WFP Executive Director Etherin Cousin has just completed a three-day visit to the Republic of South Sudan.
South Sudan is celebrating its first year anniversary as our youngest nation in the global community. And it's also one of our poorest. It's a country where hundreds of thousands of people have returned home with nothing. And what WFP is doing is providing them with food assistance as soon as they arrive, creating resilience programs that will help ensure that families can feed their own children.
Gu Kailai, the wife of the disgraced Chinese politician Bu Xilai, has been given a suspended death sentence for murdering the British businessman Neil Haywood last November. Her household aide, who admitted helping with the murder, was jailed for 9 years. New Zealand's Prime Minister has said that the deaths of three soldiers in Afghanistan will not lead to an early withdrawal of troops. Heather Roy is New Zealand's former Associate Defence Minister.
All soldiers, whether they be male or female, know when they leave the country to go on deployment that they are putting their lives on the line. It's a risky business.
Foreign ministers from across South America have backed Ecuador in its dispute with the UK over the asylum of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's taken refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Mr. Assange's mother, speaking in Australia, said the press has continued to misreport the facts of the alleged sexual offences about which the Swedish authorities want to question her son.
The women were not WikiLeaks volunteers. They did not accuse Julian of rape. He did not flee Sweden. He got permission to leave on the 15th of the 9th of September 2010 by the Swedish prosecutor. And he has not been charged with any crime by Sweden. And he's wanted for questioning only, and he has sought to obtain that questioning for the last 2 years from Sweden, but they keep to come up with all sorts of excuses why not to question him.
In Europe, a new ferry link has begun operating today between the two major passenger ports of Calais in France and Dover in the UK. The company called My Ferry Link is leasing three vessels from the former Sea France fleet, which finished its services in November last year. The new company is run as a workers' cooperative, and its first crossing took place today with an empty ferry, but has now established itself as a player in a very tight market. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Roger. It's 21:06 in Moscow, it's 18:06 here in London, and 13:06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist ja Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
Shandai, Efrog Newydd, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
One of the many disadvantages of dictatorships is that they tend not to plan for orderly transitions of power, or indeed any transition of power. When a tyrant falls, whether removed by angry mob, coup d'etat, foreign intervention, or the reaper's scythe, what tends to follow is a dangerous and volatile chaos. If one wants to look for a bright side to Bashar al-Assad's surprisingly tenacious grip on Syria, it's that it has provided plenty of opportunity for planning what happens when his regime does eventually crumble. Among those who fancy their chances are a group of Syrian opposition figures who have been meeting for months under the auspices of Germany's Institute for International and Security Affairs. Well, joining me now to consider what they might be considering is David Schenker of the Washington Institute. David, first of all, what do we know about these discussions in Germany?
Well, we know actually there's pretty active U.S. involvement. The U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a U.S.-sponsored NGO, if you can actually call it that, has been working on this along with the Syrians. A guy named Steve Heidemann, who is a senior official at USIP and a longtime Middle East analyst, has been leading up the team. And they're talking about issues about what to do the day after, how to support democratic transition in Syria, issues like security sector reform, what to do with the judiciary, transitional justice, et cetera. So it's, they have a lot of paper they've put out, and apparently there's some buy-in.
And from where does this particular gathering of people derive its mandate to act as a sort of government in exile?
Well, the Syrians themselves have put together something called the National Syrian Council, which is a sort of an umbrella organization. You can argue, and I think many Syrian oppositionists argue that this organization, which is based in Turkey, has been stacked with Islamists, so it's not particularly representational or representative of the people of Syria. That said, they do have this large body, and there are several other opposition groups that are unrelated, members of this group and unaffiliated personnel are seem to be taking part in the discussions, and along with trying to contact people on the ground in Syria who are not part of this exiled leadership cadre.
And what lessons do you think will have been learned, or probably a better question is, what lessons do you hope might have been learned from the many recent exercises in post-tyranny nation building, which we've seen happening to varying extents in Tunisia, Libya, Iraq, Egypt, Afghanistan?
Well, see there are a lot of lessons to learn. I think, you know, coming from a U.S. point of view, our hardest lesson has been that of Iraq, where for whoever was responsible, the military was dismissed when Paul Bremer was the viceroy of Iraq. And that resulted, of course, in, you know, a million people no longer getting paid who possessed weapons. And that's not really a good formula for post-conflict, you know, stabilization. You know, so I think, you know, it's going to be a very difficult issue, but what we're going to have to really focus on is how you go about transitional justice without picking apart entirely or dismantling entirely both the security apparatus and the bureaucracy, so that you have the framework of something that exists without and have justice and with getting rid of the remnants of the former regime without, you know, basically getting rid of everything.
Well, I mean, that's one of the questions, though, isn't it, which Iraq threw into very stark focus, as in what is actually more important? Is it theoretical ideas, largely theoretical ideas like justice and democracy, or is it the practicalities of stuff like infrastructure, running water and security? Which one of those do you think you prioritize?
Well, you know, we only will have some say in that. You know, there are different experiences right now. For example, you've had although it's now Islamist government and it's not going to be particularly pro-West or pro-U.S., in Egypt, you have what has been a relatively smooth, I'd say, transition to civilian control of the military that may end up being a bad result or if you have the Islamists do crazy things. But you also have a record number of people right now in Egypt who are getting sick, stomach viruses and things like that, because there's no longer clean water in Cairo. This is very dangerous. It's hard to walk and chew gum at the same time when you're going about these transitions. The people on the ground are going to determine what their priorities are, and you hope that they work on reconstruction along with, at the same time, internationally assisted and transition to a democratic government. But it's hard to get both those things right at the same time. There might be so many grudges, and for good reason. Obviously, you're having 20,000-30,000 people killed so far, that the hopes for retribution could outweigh the efforts to get things back on track and recreate a post-Assad Syria.
In a situation like this, and we've seen pretty much the full gamut of possibilities in the Arab Spring, from sort of, you know, death to exile to being put on trial, how important is what happens to the actual dictator?
Well, I think it's very important so that the people of the country have a feeling that that justice has been meted out. There are, of course, going to be a lot of conflicts with this. In Libya, for example, there's a fight between the International Criminal Court and the government of Tripoli about who gets to try Gaddafi's son, Saif Islam, for war crimes. In Iraq, it was thought to be very important that Saddam Hussein would be tried domestically and justice meted out at home. But I think it's important one way or the other that the people that were responsible for not only the Bashar Assad regime, but the Hafez al-Assad regime before him, the people that brought you 40 years of murder and tyranny, get what they deserve, administered in a rule of law fashion by the people of Syria. And I think the international community can help play a role to help the Syrians to do justice the right way. But it's going to be very important that the people see that there are consequences and that they have been somehow, that retribution and legal retribution has been carried out.
David Shanker from the Washington Institute, thank you very much for your time. We'll be back in a moment on Midori House to hear why Burma has, at last, decided to free its press a bit.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
It's 18:15 here in London. That's 10:15 a.m. in Seattle. This is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. A free press is one of the most reliable indicators of a free society. Thomas Jefferson, no less, once declared that he'd rather live with newspapers but no government than government but no newspapers. After 50 years of rigorous restriction of its press, Burma has announced a tentative removal of pre-publication censorship. Earlier, Monocle's Emma Nelson was joined by Mark Farman, a director of the Burma campaign. Emma started by asking for the complete picture, Burma still being some way from being something that Jefferson would have recognised as a democracy.
What we've got here, if you think of censorship, there's a very large tree, and what we've seen today is one of the branches cut off. But the roots of the tree, the trunk, is still there. There's a lot of other ways that censorship is applied. What has happened today is that the advanced censorship for print media will no longer take place. So the media can now just go ahead and print articles without having to submit them first. But there are still issues, areas that they are not allowed to report on, things they're not allowed to say. So journalists are left in the position of having to guess now, you know, whether, you know, are we going too far by printing this article? And if they do, then, you know, the publication could be shut down or suspended. This is something that happened previously under the military government, and with the new military-backed government, they've been doing that to journals as well. So, you know, a suspension of 2 or 6 months for publishing an article that the government didn't like is still a possibility and has still been happening under the current government.
So do you think there is some reticence remaining that we're now in a situation where, you know, it's publish and be damned?
In Burma, it literally is damned, because you can go to horrific jail cells for actually publishing something like that, and that is a very real threat. The problem is this is a reform that is like many other reforms in Burma in the past year. It's gaining a lot of positive headlines, and of course any relaxation of censorship rules in Burma is welcome. We have to welcome that. It's a positive step, but I wouldn't say it's not even a half measure. It doesn't even go halfway. You know, none of the laws that have been used to jail journalists have been repealed. There's no laws introduced that guarantee journalists have the freedom to report that there's real freedom of expression in Burma. What has happened is a top-down approach again, where the president has decided that one of the laws the government has on the books will not be applied. But literally at the stroke of the president's pen, all of these laws can be reintroduced.
Given all that, can you eventually see a free press in Burma?
The big question is how genuine the government of Burma are. They are making some reforms, and they're saying, oh, it's, you know, obviously it's going to take us a long time. But when they actually do deliver on the few reforms that they have delivered on so far, are typical of what's happened today. They haven't lifted all media censorship. They haven't introduced any laws that guarantee journalists' rights. It's a halfway where, at the end of the day, they still have the power. And the international community, though, these half measures have been enough to persuade them to lift sanctions, to normalize relations, trade delegations going in. So where is the incentive for the government to keep reforming? They wanted to get the sanctions lifted. They wanted to get normalized international diplomatic relations. They're getting that now without having to introduce a genuine democracy, without having to introduce real freedoms like for freedom of the press. So we're just, it's a fingers crossed approach that the international community is taking. Let's hope that these military men have somehow had an epiphany and will go ahead and deliver true reforms.
That was Mark Farman, a director of the Burma campaign. But how do journalists operate in Burma and other countries whose governments also act as editors? Emma also spoke with Gwen Robinson, the Financial Times correspondent in Bangkok, and Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. They started with censorship in Thailand.
There is an astonishingly topsy-turvy system of censorship there, isn't it? But it's endemic in the culture and has been for almost a century.
That's right. Well, Thais love gossip, that's one thing. And it's amazing what you can read about people's private lives in the media here. Everyone, that is, except the royal family. And as I think most people have heard, there's a there's a vast and very serious, deep reverence for the royals, but particularly the king here. And people can go to jail and do for more than 20 years just for maybe a comment you might think is mildly, you know, mildly insulting. And anything worse, and they really throw the book at you.
And that doesn't just apply to Thai nationals, does it? Because there was a British author who wrote what he claimed was an incredibly light-hearted book, but he ended up in deep trouble.
There's been various foreigners. I think the worst case was last year, where there was an American national, but who was Thai-born, who translated some sections of an offending biography of the king, posted it on the web. He lived in America. He was an American citizen. He came to Thailand, got off the plane, was having a holiday or staying somewhere up north, and was arrested and put in jail for an act of posting this, you know, allegedly offensive stuff on the web from America on a site there. So that was very chilling, actually.
Andrew, may I turn to you now? Monocle has had its fair share of fun and games dealing with international press censorship, Beirut in particular.
The instance of Beirut and Lebanon is almost more comical. So, for example, when I've been through Rafik Hariri Airport and picked up a copy of Monocle, and you open the pages and they have this kind of special kind of tape. It looks like silver on one side and it's very sticky. And they literally cut it out and they stick it over stories that offend them. And the stories that offend them all the time are anything to do with Israel. So we've done two or three big stories on Israel and you flip through the magazine and there it is kind of covered up. But they're quite scrupulous. They go through and they find even small mentions. So, you know, a story that on the page is only, you know, 2 or 3 inches tall, it's still covered up with sticky tape to make sure that you can't read it.
Were you surprised by that?
Well, especially because it's a complex country, like as you know, but in many ways, lots of things go in Lebanon, and it's very Western, and you see so many influences around. But they've had quite a few run-ins, and I think it's, at the moment, Hezbollah is the kind of lead party in the government, so they have kind of very, you know, strong views about anything to do with Israel. The church is very strong in Lebanon, so that there's a moral question. So the censors are suddenly, they're caught up in all sorts of issues, and there have been, you know, there've been demonstrations in the last year or so. There's been a few good organisations campaigning against this, but they're seeing an increasing number of censorship issues, and on the whole, they're kind of almost bonkers. They're things you would never, you know, they banned the Da Vinci Code because they said the film was offensive to the church. There's also this rumour within Lebanon that, in fact, one of the reasons that the internet is so useless and so slow is that they kind of deliberately wind it down so that it makes it difficult for bloggers and things to get away with things. And just one other little funny detail, I did notice that in 2009, Francis Ford Coppola wanted to visit Beirut, but they wouldn't let his plane land because parts of the plane were made in Israel. So that's how strict they are against, you know, allowing any influence from Israel into the country.
That was Gwen Robinson, the FT's woman in Bangkok, and Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck with our Emma Nelson talking about press censorship. It's 23 minutes past the hour, and we'll be talking about this week's top foreign affairs stories in a moment, but we're going to stay in Burma now for some music. This is the Myanmar Girls, Myanmar, so you see what they did there, with No Pure Pea. That was the Myanmar Girls from Burma with No Pure Pea. You're listening to Midori House. And it's Monday on Midori House, and that means it's time for a survey of stories pertaining to Section A of Monocle magazine. Joining me now in the studio is Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Tom, good evening.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. What have you been reading about or thinking about writing about?
Well, you know, what I was interested in today is news of Norway's sovereign wealth fund. Now, whilst that may not sound like the most compelling story, I think it's really interesting. This is a huge fund. It was an experimental project. It was never expected to last even as long as it's lasted. It's sort of a shelf life of around 20 years. But it's going from strength to strength. And some of the statistics associated with it are staggering, and it's the success story just continues. It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. This is the fund that basically reinvests all of the monies and surplus that Norway makes from its prodigious oil exports and reinvests them for the people. It's absolutely astonishing. It has it will have over $1 trillion in assets under management within the next decade, and even at the moment it's worth around $600 billion in terms of assets under management, which is far bigger than any other equivalent, even the sovereign wealth funds from the Middle Eastern states and that kind of thing.
It has just lost about 300 million kroner while you were just talking.
Well, this is one of these extraordinary things. It's all about transparency and ethical investment. It's so transparent that they even have a tracker.
They do. I'm looking at it right now. It's quite, actually, it's going back up a bit, down a bit, up a bit.
Well,
it is quite mesmerizing. The fund market value in North Korean, got confused there. Norwegian kroner right now is just under 3.7 trillion. That's 3,700 billion. That's quite a lot of money.
It's plenty, isn't it?
So if they are going back down, God, it's in a death spiral now. They could be broke by the time we're off air at this rate.
But one of the things that I really like about this is precisely that. It's all about transparency, so you can find out how many shares in Apple it owns, how many shares in Google. The ethical investment has always been one of the kind of founding principles. So they had an advisory council on ethics that was founded about 8 years ago, and they issued regulations in terms of what constituted an ethical investment. And they got rid of a load of... They made this huge divestment of about over $2 billion in businesses and companies that simply didn't fulfill the criteria. These were people who exported certain kinds of arms or tobacco manufacturers, all this kind of thing. So it's always held up as a, you know, the way to do things, as an example to the rest of the world about responsible investment and responsible corporate strategy. And what's interesting, there's a really good piece in the Financial Times today suggesting that they should be much more bold in their investment strategy. And in fact, they're still rather passive in terms of how they try and just reflect market trends. And they don't try and get really ahead of the market. They don't take a really active fund manager's stance.
Wouldn't the obvious rebuttal to that be that they don't need to take risks? They are a small country sitting on what is, though it's going back up a bit again now. So this does get quite mesmerising. You just watch billions just arriving and vanishing.
Maybe it can just be the publicity of Monocle 24.
It could be. Perhaps everything we're saying...
A shot in the
perhaps
arm.
Perhaps everything we're saying is causing fluctuations running into the millions. But why do they need to be more aggressive and enterprising? They are a small country sitting on... I mean, they're basically a geostrategic Scrooge McDuck sitting in his vault in a big pile of money.
Well, I hopefully that mindset will prevail. I think there's... Whilst we can all applaud them for not investing in tobacco groups or not investing in companies like Walmart that would be second nature to most portfolios from pension funds, for example, I quite agree, and I don't think they shouldn't adopt a more risky strategy, because it's a success story already. And I think it just reflects the fact that even if you're doing something really well and defying expectation, there'll always be naysayers who say, well, you should be doing these things differently, you should be more speculative, you should be more, you know, less risk averse. And it'll be very interesting to see whether these efforts that they're making to free it up and be slightly bolder will translate into significant growth. Because as you point out, it's almost like what would they do with this money if they got any bigger? As I said, they're already so far ahead. They actually own it broadly 1% of all global equities.
By my estimation, admittedly unscientific, they could already afford to buy Sweden and have it bronzed. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for joining us. In the next half an hour of the programme, we will be wondering if the staff of Ecuador's embassy in London have started to grasp what they might have let themselves in for. But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. More than 250 miners are appearing at a magistrate's court in Pretoria, South Africa today, facing charges including murder, attempted murder and assault after 44 people were killed in a week of violence at Lonmin Mine, northwest of Johannesburg. Former world chess champion Garry Kasparov says he plans to open a criminal case for assault against a Moscow police officer whilst Kasparov was at the Pussy Riot verdict protests. And meanwhile, a court in Moscow has turned down a petition from a gay activist who wished to be allowed to hold gay pride rallies in Moscow in 2012 for the next 100 years as well. The United Nations World Food Programme has started the first in a series of airdrops that aim to replenish rapidly diminishing food stocks for more than 100,000 people who fled to South Sudan to escape the fighting north of the border. Gu Kailai, the wife of the disgraced Chinese politician Bo Xilai, has been given a suspended death sentence for murdering the British businessman Neil Haywood last November. New Zealand's Prime Minister has said that the deaths of three soldiers in Afghanistan will not lead to an early withdrawal of troops. Foreign ministers from across South America have backed Ecuador in its dispute with the UK over the asylum of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's taken refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Roger. As Julian Assange's Ecuadorian standoff enters its third month, more than a few of the staff of the Central American country's London embassy must be contemplating the example of Joseph Minzetti and wishing their receptionist had possessed the wit to tell Assange that he'd got the wrong address and that this was a dry cleaner or something. Cardinal Joseph Minzetti was a Hungarian archbishop who claimed asylum at the US embassy in Budapest following the Soviet Union's invasion of Hungary in 1956 and stayed there for 15 years. Well, joining us now is Monocle's man in Budapest, Adam Labor. Adam, first of all, could you tell us a bit about the Cardinal and about his story?
Joseph Minzetti was a Catholic archbishop, and as such, he was very strongly anti-communist. So when the communists took power in 48 or 49, they went after him and put him into prison on a trial that most people seem to think correctly was a sort of trumped-up show trial sort of thing they specialized in. And then he got out in 56 during the revolution. But he didn't leave the country. So unlike a lot of Hungarians who did leave the country at that time. And then he was given political asylum at the American embassy because it was obvious that the Russians would, try and put him back on trial or put him back in prison.
It does seem extraordinary, and it must have seemed extraordinary at the time, that this situation was maintained for 15 years. Were there ever points at which the US sort of tried to ease him out of the building, or whether the USSR threatened to go in and get him?
Well, it was interesting, and there are some kind of parallels with the Julian Assange case, but it's different in a way, though, because remember, during this time, this was at the height of the Cold War. He was there from 56 to 71. And really, the world wasn't in a state of flux like it is now. Things weren't changing so much. There wasn't the internet. There wasn't the kind of information flow that there was now. Something like WikiLeaks was unimaginable. So it was a kind of sort of accepted thing. And Eastern Europe then was behind the Iron Curtain. It was sort of cut off, really. So it was accepted. I think the Americans certainly wanted a solution to it, that's for sure. One thing which is notable is that the American embassy in Budapest is rather more spacious and luxurious than the Ecuadorian embassy. He didn't have to go and stand on the balcony to get some fresh air. He had his room. He was quite well looked after. I've actually had a chat with American diplomats about this a little while ago. There's a kind of courtyard, garden-type space in the embassy. It covers most of a block. So it's, sure, he was stuck inside there, but the conditions were rather more comfortable.
I mean, I'm sure it was in and of itself not a disagreeable place to spend time, but what do we know of his day-to-day life? I mean, if you're stuck in an embassy for 15 years, what do you do all day?
Well, I think he read and he prayed and he wrote. I mean, as an archbishop, I think he had obviously quite strong spiritual reserves. He's already been in prison for a while. And I think anyone that was a believing Catholic on communism knew that they were going to have difficulties and they were going to have to draw on their own inner strengths. So he did that. And I also think he realized that eventually he would be out, especially as during the 60s and 70s things thawed out a bit. But the thing is, of course, he never knew how long he would be there. That's the difficult bit. Whereas, even if you're sent to prison for 10 years, you can count the days and know you're going to get out at some stage. It might have lasted longer, but it didn't.
And has the case been mentioned much in Hungary in reference to Assange?
Yeah, there have been a few references to it, yeah, because of the obvious parallels and because it happened in downtown Budapest. And it certainly has stirred up memories of that case, absolutely.
And how is Minzetti remembered in Hungary now?
Well, it depends who you talk to. People on the right side, the right wing of politics, remember him as an anti as an anti-communist hero. People on the left who, you know, may have some sympathy for the old communist regime think he was a rather reactionary figure, very right-wing, and, you know, part of an era which has gone now, you know, of 1930s clericalism and a very strong and very influential Catholic Church.
I'm sure the Ecuadorians are looking upon this precedent with a certain amount of trepidation, to say nothing of Julian Assange, who I think reading and writing I can see, praying possibly not so much. Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up, some more music and our weekly survey of the books business.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests. And we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first Entrepreneur's Guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop.
The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 and this is M83 with OK Pal. That was M83 with OK Pal. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and it's time for our weekly survey of the business of books. And joining me now in the studio is Philip Jones, editor of The Bookseller. Philip, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It is we're up to. DRM, the vexed question thereof. There's a development with Hachette trying to enforce it or take it away or...
So what's happened is that in America there's a publisher, a science fiction fantasy publisher called Tor, that wants to publish its authors without digital rights management, which just means as a reader, you can do with that digital file as you wish. You can move it to a different reader. You can send it to a friend. You can do with it pretty much the same as what you do with a printed book, which is lend it, give it to a different person, put it on a different reader. Now, that is a unilateral decision that Tor has made, and Hachette UK, via its Little Brown imprint over here, has warned authors that are published by Little Brown over here and Tor in the US that they shouldn't sign these contracts because they worry that there will be leakage, that US editions will come into the European market or the UK market as a result of DRM being lifted. Now, they do have contractual right on their side. In most author contracts or agent negotiated contracts, there is a clause which says both the publisher and the author has to do what they can to fight piracy and fight that kind of territorial leakage that they're warning about. So they may just be dotting the I's, crossing the T's of their contractual obligations, or it may be more of a fundamental worldview that they have that DRM is right.
What would be the advantage from their point of view, though? Because surely this is inviting the same disaster that befell the music industry with the advent of MP3. It's one thing, obviously, to lend somebody a record, but another thing entirely to just be able to send a file to as many people as you like by pushing a button.
Yeah. I mean, where they're coming from is they want regular readers, most readers who probably don't even know what DRM is, never mind how to break it, to not suddenly have the ability to push those files on or lend them on or transfer them to different devices. They want them to buy them effectively. They argue that the reader recommendation is one of the strongest drivers of sales, and therefore they don't want a reader to be able to transfer that file to their friend's device because DRM is missing. Now they argue again with good grounds in the UK. Via Amazon, they have a very strong, very, very good, growing, very sizable now ebook business that is DRM'd as much as you like. So they're arguing that DRM works for them, that it doesn't need to be broken or removed from their ebook files, that everything is fine. Of course, the digerati and people who have lived through the music industry and their removal of DRM after years of agonizing pain are arguing differently. And most people think that through experimentation, publishers will eventually go the same way as the music industry. But there is a big DRM business in the UK at present, and Hachette don't want to rock the boat.
Well, moving along to another story, I guess, about the consumption of old school publishing by new school publishing. Google's purchase of Frommers, the travel book publisher. Are they trying to create the sort of long-awaited Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy variety interactive, instantly updated travel guide?
Yes, that's a simple answer. They bought Zagat, which is a well-known restaurant reviews and hotel review service in America. Zagat still publishes print books, so it's still old school. But now if you use Google Locals, Zagat recommendations and reviews will come up when you do a search for a New York hotel. And they want to do the same with Frommers travel guide information. What's interesting from the publisher's point of view is that Google, for years and years and years, has shown no respect for copyrighted material. And suddenly they're in the publishing business. And they're going to have to work out how to monetize that. That's interesting.
I mean, how is the market for traditional travel guides holding up? Because I can't understand why anybody would use one anymore, because by definition, all the information in a travel guide is going to be 2 years old.
In the last 5 years, the printed travel guide market sold through UK high street and travel shops has gone down by about 30%. So it is tanking. It's still around about £50 million in UK high street sales of physical guides, but it's all moving online. I mean, most travel guide publishers like Lonely Planet have apps and ebooks and a thriving social community that they use to leverage more content to their guides and sell direct to consumers. So travel publishers know where the market is going. Google's just getting there a little bit faster than what they might like.
And finally then, the advent of another device on which we might conceivably read a Google stroke from as travel guide. The Barnes & Noble equivalent to the Kindle is about to be turned loose on the UK.
Yes, in October, Barnes & Noble is going to launch Nook UK, which I would say we've been waiting for as in the UK publishing scene for at least a year. They promised something in April. We were holding our breath for a deal with Waterstones. It never happened. Now they're going to launch just a standalone Barnes & Noble Nook UK website, and they will sell devices and content. And this is in a sense, a great moment for consumers and for the publishing trade, because Amazon is so dominant, as it was in the UK before Barnes & Noble launched the Nook and really took the fight to Amazon. So they're a very good ebook merchandiser. They know what customers want, they know where the market is, they know how to deal with publishers. Barnes & Noble has wanted to be in the UK market for decades and decades. Finally, it's got here. It's got here only through a website, but that's okay for now.
What's the difference between the Nook and the Kindle, or even one of the other platforms like an iPad?
Between the Kindle and the Nook devices are basic e-ink devices where you just read, and that's a great virtue for people who just like to read books, and that's been what Amazon has really, I think, invented. It's invented a device that is purely about reading, which has really appealed to hardcore readers, which is why the ebook transition has been slightly ahead of what most people thought it would be, because the heavy book buyers have really taken to those devices. So the Nook will compete head on with the Kindle. The iPad is obviously a tablet device. You do more on it than read. So research suggests that people who buy iPads read much less than they do if they buy an e-ink reader. So from the publishing industry's perspective, we want more e-readers, at least until those devices merge into one great e-reading multimedia device, which hasn't really happened yet.
How difficult do you think it's going to be for them to break into this market, which has been already dominated by the established Kindle? What are they able to say to people that our device does that Kindle doesn't?
Not a lot, but what they'll do that Amazon also does very well, which is retail ebooks superbly. I think barnesandnoble.com does challenge Amazon in the States, and also they do leverage their stores in the US in a way that Amazon can't. At least it won't be able to until it does its Waterstones deal over here in September, and then we'll see what a high street version of the Amazon Kindle experience is like. But I think what Barnes and Noble will do is just retail merchandise ebooks as well as Amazon, and there's no one really doing that in the UK quite as well. Kobo's thereabouts, but it's not yet making a lot of headspace. When Barnes & Noble really went for this market in the US, it grew to 20% very quickly. It lost a hell of a lot of money doing it, and it's still losing a lot of money doing it, and there's a debate about whether Barnes & Noble has really the money to reach overseas. But you know, it's a proper bookseller in a way that Amazon is a bookseller, but also lots of other things. So I think the publishing industry is a little cheered today by the fact that Barnes & Noble, even though it's a giant American bookseller, they're still cheered that it's coming this way.
Philip Jones, editor of The Bookseller, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. It's 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Next, we will be discussing the world of album artwork, but first, some new music. This is Wildest Moments by Jesse Ware. Wildest Moments by Jesse Ware. You're listening to Midori House. Every Saturday on the Weekend Edition, Monocle 24 brings you a relaxed mix of music, headlines and other edifying programme. This past Saturday, Georgina Godwin was joined in the studio by Nick Robertson from the graphic design practice Word Salad. Nick shares a studio with Brian Eno, and together with Eno and Dominic Norman Taylor, he produces the installation artwork 77 Million Paintings. He also designs album covers for many musicians, including Marconi Union, the Asian Dub Foundation, Square Pusher, John Cale, and also Saints and Real World Records. He's also done visual work for Coldplay, Kylie Minogue and U2. Robertson explained to Georgina how the process works and where his industry is headed in the digital age.
Whenever you work in the music industry, or in fact in any area of publishing, you don't really have a client, you have three clients. So what you embark on is a kind of negotiation between those three clients. The three clients are myself, because obviously I need to satisfy my own sort of design and artistic inclination. Mm-hmm. The other, which is a much more simple negotiation, is with the musician, who may or may not have ideas about how they see the visual side of their album. Mm-hmm. A much more complex one is the record company. When the digital revolution of music came in, i.e. when downloading started, there was an idea that this was somehow the end of the album cover. This was the end of the product, the physical product. In fact, nothing of the kind has happened. Exactly the opposite has happened, actually. What record companies are doing now, in order to keep the physical product alive, is to understand that what they need to produce are works of art, are objects of desire, something that people want to own because of the physicality of it.
And in terms of the terminology, that's still just referred to as an album cover, even though it's actually often not. It's a digital piece of art.
Yes.
Yeah.
Album covers are not obsolete yet. But the situation that we've got at the moment is that record companies are striating their release. So you've got the standard release, you've got the slightly nicer release, and you've got the deluxe release, which could be very elaborate indeed.
And will be limited edition and all the rest of it.
Of course, yeah, numbered. And it'll be a desirable collectible object, because they're still catering for people of my generation who...
Nick, incidentally, is all of 40, I would say.
Who were used to collecting, you know, vinyl. Vinyl's made a huge comeback. So what's happened is not that the designer has become obsolete in the musical process. What's actually happened is that there are fewer designers working in it, but they've got much more indulgence.
So talk me through the creative process, because is it that they say to you, right, we want a picture of a lightning bolt, or they say, listen to the music and tell us what moves you? You know, how does that work?
It entirely depends on the artist and the record company. Often what I get, because of the nature of the record companies I work with and the nature of the artists I work with, is that I get given the music, and a large part of being a designer is about responding to things. Design tends to come after the main event, as opposed to fine art, which is its own thing. So what I tend to get is, here's the music, what do you think? Obviously, the record company has a marketing department, and they always have an agenda and an opinion. And this is where the negotiation comes in, that, you know, you have to trust in your own response, but also take on board the opinions of the record company and the artist as well. So what you end up with at the end of it is a mutually satisfying product, hopefully.
That the artist loves, you love, and of course that the public are going to love, and that it's going to make the public want to buy it.
Of course.
That was Nick Robertson from Word Salad talking to Georgina Godwin on the Weekend Edition. And that's all from this edition of Midori House. The producer was Daniel Giacopelli. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Ben Jay. I'll be back for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson 3 hours from now at 2200 hours UK time. But for now, from all at Midori House, goodbye and thanks for listening.